Welcome back, everybody. This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast, episode 43. I'm Courtney. With me, as always, is my co-host, Max Flight. Max, how are you?
I'm good, Court. How's everybody?
And we are a little bit late this week as we're recording on a Tuesday night rather than our normal Sunday night. This due, of course, to Easter. But it is a podcast nonetheless. In fact, we had originally toyed with the idea of not doing one this week. So be thankful for what you get, huh?
Yeah.
Regardless, we do have quite a bit to talk about, and not least of which is the chance to speak once again with our guest. We're talking with Richard Abalafia yet once again. He is from the Teal Group and is also the author of his blog at richardabalafia.com. Richard, again, thank you for joining us.
Oh, pleasure. Hey, guys, how's it going?
It's great. Great to have you back.
Oh, pleasure. What was I on, 21 or 25, or which one was I?
I'm searching. See, now you put me in the spot. 27.
27, right. Okay, well, 27, 43, terrific.
27, and I'll have you know that since then I've become a master at spelling your last name.
Ah, well, okay. That probably beats out most of my immediate family and in-laws, but good, good, excellent.
Well, Richard, thanks again for joining us, and we do have quite a bit of news, so what do you say we jump right into it?
Let's get started.
First up this week from Reagan.com. This is my favorite news story of the week, aviation related anyways. Long Beach City Council mad at blogger for reporting inconvenient facts. The Long Beach, California City Council is fuming at the author of the Cranky Flyer aviation blog, Brett Snyder, for the interview he did with JetBlue CEO Dave Barger. In the interview, Barger told Snyder the airline was so frustrated with the slow pace of improvements at Long Beach that it could eventually pull out if the pace didn't pick up. This from USA Today. The story was picked up and reported on by much of the LA area media. How exactly did the city council react? Well, they're mad at Brett. They're mad at the blogger for writing the post and angry at mainstream press for picking up the story. Long Beach Mayor Bob Foster said, "We should not take blogs as professional journalism, and the professional journalists should take that as well." He also said, "The internet's, that's not real."
Yeah.
He didn't actually say that. But the best part of this article is Brett's response. He says, "It doesn't matter if this was written on a bathroom wall," he says. "It came directly from the CEO of the largest airline at this airport. Does it really do any good to try to discredit blogs or traditional media in the process? No. It also shows that the city council members are quite out of touch with the current state of reporting." This it almost seems like something that came from The Onion.
It really is, you know, but he's got a point. Journalists shouldn't use bathroom stalls for sources. Analysts, however, should, and I do on a routine daily basis.
Some of the best material.
Very well said. And we were mentioning to Richard before we started recording the podcast that we are starting to take on the Richard Abalafia quote of the week, because there's always a hilarious quote out there. Unfortunately, this week, Richard, you didn't win your own contest. Brett Snyder won for his "It Doesn't Matter If It Was Written on a Bathroom Wall" comment. So congratulations, Brett.
That's a superb. I wish I'd thought of that. That's really good. Well justified. So what is this the city council going to do next? Form like special execution squads for other messengers, you know?
They're going to take out all the bloggers.
Apparently they have no PR training. It's almost like they received the news, were so upset, they didn't have a chance to really process it, and they just blurted out the first thing that came to mind.
I should recuse myself because I'm just mad at them because there's the world's best restaurant on the second floor. There used to be, anyway, of that terminal. And if you want a place to watch all kinds of assorted business jets and other random planes, including once a NASA T-38 chase plane I saw, this is the place to do it. And they also happen to have an excellent chicken fried steak. I hope it's still there, and I hope it's reopened, but I was getting mad at them while they closed it.
That's two strikes, Long Beach. two very
That's what Stephen
strikes.
Colbert would say. You are on notice, Long Beach.
You are on notice.
I think we ought to encourage everyone to start writing on the bathroom walls at the airport.
Crankyflyer.com.
Well, you know, the whole thing is, I mean, in one sense, it's incredible. In another sense, it's amusing, but it really shows or illustrates, you know, once again, that the, you know, blogging or, you know, online news, you know, social media, whatever you want to call it, is it's changing the game, and not everybody really understands how that game has changed. And the mayor of Long Beach seems to be kind of trailing the pack in that regard.
For them to show anger at it is kind of what baffles me. It's not even anything Brett Snett. I mean, it's what Barger said.
Right. Brett just reported the interview
right.
he
and
had.
It's a great interview, I might add.
With a guy who matters.
So if you're keeping track, Long Beach City Council is now on notice for the Cranky Flyer incident, as well as the Mexican restaurant closure.
Well, it was a restaurant that I think was Mexican influenced. At least they had bottles of that really yummy Cholula hot sauce on each table.
Oh my gosh! Just what you need before getting on the airplane, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this is a good point. It's a bigger issue in aviation and probably any industry. You know, I mean, good PR training is hard enough to find, and the corporations and airlines as it is. I mean, there's some, but it's, you know, a lot of places just haven't gotten the message. And the whole blogger thing just adds a whole new element of uncertainty for them and even more things to work on because the rules have changed. As you say, there's sort of a Matt Drudge sensibility that's taken things over.
Certainly.
Rather than the great lady of the New York Times and that sort of thing. So things are different.
So as members of the new media community, we support you, Brett Snyder.
Yeah, there. Absolutely.
Bathroom wall reading.
In your bathroom wall literature. Okay, moving into the next story. This from the Manila Bolton Publishing Corporation. Never heard of it. Good article, though. World Aviation Body calls for implementation of PBN. Major stakeholders of the world aviation community signed a declaration calling for the rapid implementation of performance-based navigation, PBN, a new air navigation concept that will contribute to further improving the safety, efficiency, and sustainability of the global air transport system. What is PBN, you may ask? Well, it sets clear performance requirements for any given flight operation, involves a major shift from conventional ground-based navigational aids and procedures to satellite-based navigation aids and area navigation procedures, which are more accurate, allow for shorter, more direct routes between two given points, as well as more efficient takeoffs and landings.
Which is next-gen ATA in FAA speak, right?
Sure.
I really don't see the whole point, honestly. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the random collection of Wang computers and Donkey Kong games that constitute the present FAA system. I really don't see any reason to drag it into the 20th century. I just don't.
No, it's good for nostalgia, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, as much as we complain about the golden age of aviation and how much we miss it, we don't realize what we have in our air traffic control system.
Right. I think. Explain.
Well, it's how great it was when there were two pilots and 10 flight attendants in tow in their hot pants and glory days of flying across the Atlantic in a DC-6. And here we have still the golden age of aviation in the control tower. We just don't realize it.
That's a superb point. So there's a certain retro quality that we should come to appreciate.
Absolutely.
I'm also reminded of, I think it was Buddy Hackett in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. You know, hey, you down there on the ground, this is us up here in the air, you know, screaming back and forth as they, there was something charming and nostalgic in '60s about that. Absolutely.
Does, how much pull does the ICAO have with U.S. aviation policy in this regard?
I expect as much as you would for any foreign organization that attempted to intrude into a sovereign American, God-given right to do whatever we want for our own bureaucracies, i.e.
So not much, huh?
Yeah, I'm thinking not so much, although the idea is good. I notice once again that the article trots out Australia and New Zealand that quite rightfully are always held up as, virtuous poster children for everything good about modernized air transport networks. And they are. You know, they're smack in the middle of some giant ocean, which I believe is called the Pacific, you know, so they're going to get good at it. The problem is that there's a real not invented here problem, both in the U.S. and other countries, that prevents us from adopting these things.
Okay, moving into our next story, this from ABC News. Trapped on a plane? Court says deal with it, and court being the courts, not myself.
Not court.
I just have to clarify each time.
Just to be clear.
A court has thrown out a lawsuit brought against American Airlines by a woman who was stranded for 9.5 hours on the tarmac in Austin, Texas in 2006. In dismissing the case, U.S. District Judge Robert Dawson said airlines are not legally bound to provide a, quote, stress-free environment when such a delay occurs.
I think they've taken it upon themselves to create a stress-inducing environment. You know, you have to wonder, reading this, if there any part of American contract law that survives contact with an airport terminal.
Yeah, it's all waived as soon as you step in the terminal.
Breach of contract, ha ha ha. Yeah, it's actually the best thing about this article, if you go to the link you sent, which is, is it ABC? Yeah, ABC News, trapped in a plane, court says deal with it. Court, not Courtney.
Thanks.
Halfway down, there's a little related link, which I need to click in after this podcast, which says simply, as one of those great teasers, the top 5 worst travel-related infections. And I'm dying to click this.
Oh, I don't think I could stand that.
There is a quote from Kate Haney. She's the founder of FlyersRights.org. You can pretty much imagine the type of thing she's going to say, but she says the bottom line is that if passengers can't get relief from the courts, we have to have Congress step in. This sets a pretty strong precedent if this is upheld. I mean, this has been, and we've talked about this, I think it was last week, Max, and that's, you know, with the Passenger Bill of Rights issue, exactly how big is the issue now with the decrease in capacity lately? And, you know, our conclusion was it's really not that bad right now. And here, this definitely doesn't help things at all either.
Yeah, if the courts aren't going to, you know, act in this area, and I maybe agree that they should not, then, it, like you say, it gives focus to the groups that are looking to implement a passenger bill of rights. And I don't know, it's such an emotional thing. I mean, if you have no stories and no incidents like this, then it you know, it'll die out and go away. But if all you need is, you know, one or a couple examples of just, you know, really horrible conditions and a really long stay out on the tarmac, and that's all the Congress is going to need to take some action.
I'm a little baffled. She herself was stranded 9.5 hours on the tarmac. Presumably that's in an aircraft. And presumably there are other people in this inevitably hellish MD-80. Why is it just why isn't there some sort of, I don't know, class action thing going on here? Because I think if it were a tube full of people, you'd find enough folks truly deeply cheesed off to create a bigger legal case here.
Seems that way.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, if I was on that plane for 9.5 hours, I think I'd be right with her. I just can't imagine sitting there for 9.5 hours. I mean, I've been on a flight for 9.5 hours, even longer, and you know, at least then you're going somewhere. You're making some kind of progress, but just to sit with stale air and, you know, lack of toilet facilities and things like that, it's just going to get unbearable. And I don't know. I would be right with her if I was stuck on a plane like that, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. As a matter of fact, you have to wonder why someone didn't succumb to some kind of medical emergency. I mean, not that I would wish it on anyone.
Right, right.
The odds, you know? I mean, 9.5 hours on, sitting in the sun, you've got, you know, people in a tense situation. Someone perhaps is on some kind of medication, you know. I'm amazed something worse didn't happen.
Wonder if any of those diseases that you mentioned are associated with sitting on the tarmac.
Well, it's funny you should ask, Max, because I took the advice of Richard and followed the related link, and I do have it says the top 5 travel-related infections, but I think there's like 6 or 7. But they are scabies, not a good one, norovirus, tuberculosis, the evil cold.
Sure.
Traveling diarrhea, which I guess is like Montezuma's revenge, and bed bugs.
Bed bugs?
I don't know. So I don't think these these are traveling, not just aviation.
Okay, not just on the airplane.
So there you go.
Gosh.
So now that we've frightened the entire community
the for traveling,
we'll move into the next story, which actually was the next story on ABC News. This story from Scott Marowitz, top 9 outrageous airline fees and extreme flying charges. There's a new fee out there, and no, it's not paying to go to the bathroom, which never really was. But drivers at Luton Airport, a venue north of London, England, favored by discount airlines, must now pay to drop off travelers. That's right. The airport is charging motorists roughly $1.50 just to pull up to the curb and let grandma out to catch her flight.
Crazy. Don't try anything.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
That's pretty innovative. Did this actually stick? I mean, is this for real? Unlike the peeing thing?
It seems like it.
Wow.
The other 8 that the author talks about, since this is a top 9, I couldn't find a 10th fee, I guess. The first one is paying to pee, and we know that that's not actually going to happen. The second is for pillows and blankets on JetBlue, the $2 soda on U.S. Airways, booking over the phone, which I tend to agree with. Some add a $15 to a $35 fee to book over the phone. Of course, then you have check bags, airport check-in. It can be as high as $15 to check in with an agent. A curbside check-in, seat assignments, and finally, they talk about their drop-off fee.
You know, I think sort of turning this on its head, there's certainly a collection, you know, it's kind of a laundry list of horror and stupidity, but, you know, to turn this on its head, no one is ever going to do a story on how the airlines do it. You can fly cross-country routinely, not crazy sale or going out of business for a zombie dying airline, but routinely charge $200 for a cross-country ticket. Right. How do they do that? No media organization is ever going to do a story on that. Certainly a trade magazine would, or a professional publication. But no one is ever going to say, you never had it so good. It is so damn cheap. Instead, people are focused on, oh my God, it's a dollar for a blanket. And they're kind of losing the bigger picture, which is that in this environment, airlines have zero pricing power, and they're desperate to do what they can to have two nickels to rub together.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, and it's, you know, there are the two ways to look at it. One, from the airline's point of view, which is, look, we are not forcing you to pay for these things. That way you can choose to pay for them. Sounds great, right? And then you've got the passengers who show up to the airport and you're charging me for what? Again?
Yeah.
So, right. there's some communication issues in there. But, you know, there are two sides to every coin. It sounds great. But still, when you got to pony up extra, it stings.
Yeah. No, it's an unfortunate fact that, you know, ancillary revenues, as they're euphemistically called, you know, charges for everything, are pretty much the only thing that's keeping this business halfway solvent these days.
Right.
I mean, it's their big hope.
You're absolutely right. Okay, moving into the next story and shifting over to the defense side of military aviation. This from Bloomberg.com. Gates proposes ending Lockheed F-22 and expediting F-35. Gates recommended capping purchases of Lockheed Martin Corporation's F-22 fighter jets at 187, and canceling the company's VH-71 presidential helicopter, while planning to buy 30 of the company's next-generation F-35 warplane in the 2010 budget, compared with 14 this year.
It's been a bizarre week. The past 7 days, this defense thing was, and I've never seen such weird reporting. People reported it as a defense cut, but it I mean, it's the same. It's the FY 2010 Bush budget, basically, unchanged except for a few minor tweaks and mods. Bush had canceled the F-22. What this budget does is add four last planes. There were hopes that they would add more planes, but basically they just get said four, and that's the end of it. What's also kind of interesting, yesterday's Washington Post contained, you know, okay, I'm a plane geek, cheerfully and enthusiastically with you guys, so I'm parochial about this, but it was the weirdest article I've ever seen in the Washington Post. It was an editorial written by the Secretary of the Air Force saying, we don't want more F-22s. And, you know, good thing it wasn't a hologram, because then you could probably see the, you know, the 45 caliber gun held up against his head. Typed out the words. But that changes this, because before that, it was a slam dunk that Congress would act on behalf of the Air Force, and of course, people who have jobs at stake, and insert more money to go beyond the 187 F-22s. But with yesterday's editorial, I think that's a bit of a game changer, perhaps.
Now, that kind of moves us right into the next story, which is all on the same topic. This on the Huffington Post, Chris Kelly did write an article that said, don't kid yourself, the F-22 lives. He says, America's arms spending will increase, but it won't increase as fast as it might have. That's why the headlines say major cuts. Defense Secretary Gates ordered four more F-22 bombers today in the budget he presented, but he said he won't order any more the year after that. This is why the headlines say Gates kills F-22, and that is misleading.
Yeah, absolutely right. It is. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's misleading in either direction. It's not a defense budget cut. On the other hand, I have no idea what the Democrats are thinking, because they appear to be talking about reinventing the military for doing more missions like Iraq. And last I checked, they just got elected on the promise to not do missions like Iraq.
Yeah.
Which means that either this is a huge rationale for killing stuff they don't like, you know, or reinventing for counterinsurgency, and even though we don't mean it. And then you've got the Republicans eager to blame Obama for, you know, the second coming of Joe Stalin. So I have no idea what's going on, but none of it looks smart. And the sort of counterweight to the F-22 is, of course, the ramp-up, quote-unquote, in the F-35. And there'll be an increase in the F-35 budget. But this is also the program of record. They're going from 16 planes in FY09 to 30 planes in FY10. And that is exactly the Bush administration program of record. So they're taking credit for a ramp-up that was supposed to happen anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a hall of mirrors here with the defense budget.
Chris Kelly does go on to mention that, you know, currently we have 183 F-22s. He says it's the world's most expensive fighter aircraft, one that's never fired a shot in anger, except against Iron Man, and I'm pretty sure that was CGI, and even there, Iron Man won.
I'd like to see that reenactment again. That was pretty cool.
Later on in the article, he says, as aerospace analyst Richard Abulafia explains, I'm sorry I can't comment. I'm busy preparing for my podcast recording this week with the Airplane Geeks.
I think that was me. It occupied the center of it was pretty much put everything on hold. A lot of annoyed clients, thanks to you, I have to tell you.
But Richard says, it was a surprise, but just enough of a tactical victory to keep the F-22 going and allow political pressure to be brought to bear.
Yeah, you know, I said that, but that was before yesterday's editorial in the Post, which again, you know, being a total plane geek, I thought it was unprecedented. The Secretary of the Air Force actually breaking ranks, General Norton Schwartz, wrote that, And I'm still amazed that this happened, which goes to show that maybe Gates is making bigger changes than people are giving him credit for, because that's pretty extraordinary.
What does this offer in terms of insight into the future of our military's aviation, in terms of both the fighter programs we're looking at here, but as well as something we haven't talked about in a bit is the tanker program? The fiasco there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the unstoppable horror of the tanker program. Can't we all just have closure? You know, it's interesting. I think we're with this, and there's talk that there won't be any more Super Hornets after another couple of years. That's also the program of record. We're heading towards a unifighter solution, Joint Strike Fighter for all three air arms and all export markets, and that's it. That's kind of interesting because, well, we're going from an era where we're used to seeing fighter aircraft that varied, that were different from each other, that did different things. Instead, we're just going to have an essentially identical family of platforms that vary with different network connections and software links and other stuff that that plane lovers might not notice. That's a change. I mean, as a kid growing up with large books of all the world's fighters and waiting for the next XF whatever to be unveiled, this could get boring fast.
But why is this? Is this because of the variations in performance brought about by software alone, or are we seeing kind of a laziness because of the lack of what we call like the Cold War, where there was a significant amount of technology on the other side, and the others now don't seem to be producing much, at least the countries that we would consider a threat aren't producing much of a very technological aircraft?
I think those are two excellent suppositions. Certainly the second, you know, it's a lot less of an incentive when you don't see wing after wing of MiG-25s about to come cruising down the Autobahn or on top of the Autobahn. The other is just as important. Basically, the aircraft are less important than the software, the off-board sensors, satellites, radars, what have you. And the fact that the aircraft themselves are being kind of eaten by their own value chain, the onboard componentry is more important, whether it's electronic warfare or electronically scanned radars or what have you, or precision-guided munitions and the links between them. They're getting to be more important in the actual shape and design of the aircraft. So that, and that, you know, lack of an incentive in the form of a direct threat, that's making our fighter universe kind of dull.
Well, what about extending that, you know, extrapolating that? You know, is the next real play unmanned vehicles? And so the F-22 and maybe even the F-35 representing, you know, kind of the end of an era. And so let's not invest, you know, too much into that kind of technology where you've got human beings riding along because, you know, maybe the future is one that's unmanned.
Oh, you're certainly seeing that, you know, in the budget announcement last week. They announced the retirement of 250 older model fighters, and they said that some of their job would be performed by Reapers, which are basically Predator UAVs with munitions. So you're seeing more of that. But this gets back to the debate. I mean, Reapers are fantastic work if you're blowing up a Toyota full of Al-Qaeda members, but if you're in a real stand-up fight, they're effectively marginal at best. So we're reinventing for a mission that in 20 years, you know, it sort of takes you back to the 1920s, 1930s. British imperial policy was, you know, classic, you know, well, your British history, just penny packets of infantry, a mountain of coal, and a gunboat going between locations policing the empire. And all of a sudden, you know, 8 million heavily armed Germans suddenly hop into view, as I think they said. Blackadder, and you never know what the wake-up call will be. But if human history is any guide, the strategic look of the next 20 years will be very different from what we're dealing with today.
Yeah, that kind of sums it all up. Whatever we're planning on, expect something else to happen.
Yeah, and well, at least defense spending doesn't look set to collapse. I mean, it looks like it'll probably ramp down a little bit, but I'm not worried about anything truly bad happening to either the defense budget or the military-industrial base. I am worried as an aircraft hobbyist because there'll be fewer cool fighters. That's about it.
Yes.
Well, moving into our main topic, or what we're going to call the main topic, Max, you had found an article in The Atlantic. Just kind of lead us through a bit about what you found.
Yeah, sure. This is an article from the March 2009 issue of The Atlantic that was written by Mark Bowden, who you may recall from some of his earlier works, which include Black Hawk Down and a number of other books. But this article, I think, is fascinating, particularly if you're have any interest at all in you know, military aircraft and fighters and kind of the history of that. And really, what Mark does is spend some time talking about a couple of things. One is the superiority of the F-15 in particular, but also just generally the air superiority that the United States has enjoyed for, you know, decades, how that's, you know, due in large part to the F-15, also the F-16. Also kind of the fact that, you know, these aircraft represented such a technological advantage over the competition that you know, it was just easy to rule the skies. At one point in the article, he makes the point that the last time an American soldier was killed by an airplane was in the Korean War, and we've just dominated since then. And he talks about that. He talks about, you know, kind of what it means in light of the F-22 and what might or might not happen with the F-22, how the F-15 is getting kind of long in the tooth, or at least in relationship to aircraft that other nations can will have or can obtain, and we just don't really have that air superiority edge, or we're about to lose it if we do something like cut back on the F-22 buys.
It was a very interesting article. The thing that kind of hit me about it was that the people who think the F-22 is a, you know, giant gold-plated $140 million waste of money are the same people who said exactly the same thing about the F-15 back in its day.
Right.
And they said, oh, you know, they say the F-22 isn't seeing combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is, I guess, also a good argument against not buying naval vessels because they're not going to see combat in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
Never mind.
Or submarines.
Or submarines, absolutely. And, you know, you look at the history of the F-15, it was considered to be overbuilt, over-technological, too complicated. And then the Israelis used it, and then Persian Gulf One happened, and it was shown to be pretty much the world's best fighter.
Exactly.
And yeah, you had the same arguments against it. Now, the F-22, I don't have any doubts about it as a plane. It's just a question of how many as a nation we can afford. And I think, unfortunately, given the circumstances, we're kind of in the hands of the budget geeks, not the airplane geeks.
Yeah, sure. Certainly there's strong impetus these days to cut back costs. And you know, something tough decisions have to be made. And, you know, those of us that enjoy aircraft, like you say, military particularly, you know, love the F-22. It's an amazing aircraft. You know, all you have to do is look at any of the, you know, videos online from the air shows where they perform, and it's just an amazing aircraft. But it is kind of a target. I mean, I think it was always kind of seen as sort of a transition aircraft between the F-15, F-16, and the Joint Strike Fighter, which is now the F-35. It was kind of a, you know, it kind of carried you over between those technologies. So I think it's always been kind of vulnerable to cutbacks.
Well, it's become that, but of course, when it was created, it was you know, more of a high-end, high-mix plane that eventually would be complemented. Over the past years, probably for a very long time now, yeah, you're right, it's become sort of an interim design. I think there was even effort to call it a wing walker strategy, where you're walking between two wings.
Yeah.
And they couldn't be disrupted, and that was an argument against cutting the F-22, but that's the way it's become. Still, it's going to be unfortunate when the last one is delivered, you know, but it might be our national budget future.
Richard, or Max, what is considered the F-22's largest competition worldwide right now?
I don't think it has any.
Yeah, I don't think it has any. Absolutely not. I mean, the F-35 has plenty of, you know, rivals. You know, I know foreign air forces have done assessments, and nothing comes even vaguely close. The thing is that all of its virtues are air-to-air rather than air-to-ground, and that's the problem. There's, Court, I believe you mentioned before the lack of anything truly compelling by way of an air-to-air threat.
One thing I thought was interesting is how you know, Bowden talks about how the F-15 and F-22 might work together in a world where there are still F-15s around and there aren't that many F-22s, which is to kind of put the F-15s you know, up front against the enemy with the F-22s close at hand, and where the F-15s get into trouble, into difficulty from an air combat standpoint. The idea would be that the F-22 would then swoop in and take advantage of its capabilities to take out the competition. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, blend of the capabilities and strategies of the two different aircraft. Of course, I think the Air Force would just as soon have a, well, I don't know about the Air Force, but certainly some people would like to see a, you know, an all F-22 fleet and just see the F-15s, you know, fade into history. But it doesn't really look like that's going to happen in the near term.
No, it was the original plan, of course, 750 F-22s as opposed to the 187 it looks like it might end with. But you look at some of the enabling upgrades that are possible for an F-15, they can be equipped with an electronically scanned radar array, as on the F-22, not as good, but still, it's a key enabling technology that would allow greater interaction. There's all kinds of things you can do to keep your F-15 fleet going, but a lot of the F-15s have simply been worn out by Iraq and Afghanistan, just heavy operations, and the fact that they're getting to be relatively old planes.
Sure. Some of them very old, decades old.
Great. I do have one more question. Whatever happened to the P designator? Like P-51, P-47?
Yeah.
That was the nomenclature of a different time, and P stood for pursuit rather than fighter. And the concept of the fighter was a very different one back then. It was almost like something that intercepted bombers or something like that, rather than the traditional concept of mass air-to-air battles. And so basically, sometime around the end of World War II, the P became the F.
Great.
I wonder which was the last P.
I think it was the P-80, but I'm not sure. That's an interesting trivia question.
It is a good trivia question.
The Lockheed P-80 might have been it. But I don't really know. I'm going to look that up.
Now, just one last thing on the F-15. I thought it was interesting that you mentioned that kill ratio is often the measure of capability of an aircraft, and the F-15's kill ratio is 107-0, meaning that nothing has ever taken down, or at least another aircraft has never taken down an F-15. Meanwhile, F-15s have taken out 107 aircraft on their own.
Now, that is a very interesting metric. The other thing that's a good point to make is that the F-15 was conceived of as an air superiority plane, just like the F-22 was. Yet when the time came, the F-15 made a superb attack plane, the F-15 Eagle, the Strike Eagle, rather, the E model. And it's simply easier to take a robust, capable, high-tech platform and make it multi-role rather than start with something smaller and try to make it dedicated and truly world's best, world-class best at any particular mission. So, again, another reason that the F-22 conceivably might be dying a bit before its full potential got to be explored.
Yes.
Sure, that's a great point. Great. Okay, thank you again so much, Richard. Again, that's Richard Abulafia. He's the Vice President of Analysis at Teal Group. He's also the author of RichardAbulafia.com, and he gets all of his analysis from bathroom stalls.
Only the better ones, though, I'd like to point out.
Only the better ones. Richard, again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys, and I look forward to doing it again soon, I hope.
Absolutely.
You bet.
Thanks again, Richard. Now we have Max with his pick of the week.
Yeah, my pick of the week really relates back to a story we covered sometime last year concerning a woman on an airplane who was accompanied by a child with autism, and there were some real difficulties with the child and how the child's behavior and the parent's response was perceived by other passengers and the flight crew, I think. And, you know, we made some comments about that. And we also mentioned that obviously we were not very knowledgeable in the areas of children with autism. Well, I see now that, Manchester Airport has a, really nice, air travel guide for children with autism. It's designed kind of specifically for the Manchester Airport in the UK. In that it has some sort of interactive exercises that the parent can conduct with their child as they go through the airport process. But I think this would be valuable for anyone that in a similar situation at a different airport. So I just wanted to pass that along. You can if you go to www.manchesterairport.co.uk, just search for autism. And the first thing that comes up in their site search will be a PDF file that has this air travel guide for children with autism. So if you are a parent of a child like that, you'll want to look at this, I think. And if you're not, but would really like to learn more about sort of the challenges of autism and how that relates to air travel, you might want to take a look at that as well. So that's my pick for this week.
Great. Thanks, Max. I do want to move into some listener emails. We did get a couple this week. I'll tell you what. We got an email from Jamie Dobson, who sent out an email to his friend saying that he is presenting a one-hour lecture about Howard Hughes, the pilot behind the legend, on May 2nd at the Hiller Aviation Museum in Santa Clara, California. He's also signing some of his books, of course, those being the books that he has written. Very interesting, especially in aviation history. You can find out more about his book at nickgrantadventures.com. So thank you, Jamie, for an update on that. We also have...
Yeah, I actually have a copy of that book, which I haven't yet read, but will, and I'll come back with a little review on it in the future.
Great. Great. We also have several news items from our Australia desk. That's Steve Vischer. And, you know, Max, I need to start just working these into the news. I don't know why I let them go to the listener feedback, but he did send a very interesting article on the Garuda crash, the 737 that crashed in Indonesia several months ago. This article comes from theage.com.au. Pain remains as Garuda pilot gets 2 years for fatal crash. A guilty verdict and 2 years jail for the pilot in the plane crash that killed her brother, along with 20 others, did nothing to soothe the pain for Caroline Mellish. Now, that article's horrible because I was confused when I read it. Max was confused when he first read it. But the pilot is a man. His brother was not on the plane, but they're talking about this other lady who had a brother on the aircraft. So the pilot of the aircraft was given a verdict of 2 years in jail for that Garuda plane crash. And why, you may ask? Well, they called it negligence. Marwato, he was the pilot, the captain, ignored 15 automated warnings described as loud whoop-whoops by the judges before the crash. Verbal warnings from the co-pilot to abort the landing were also ignored, and the plane was traveling at twice the normal speed.
Twice? My goodness.
Yeah, so that's twice the normal speed. That's 250 knots plus, if I'm doing my math correctly. But this is interesting from the aspect that this pilot was convicted in a court of law, in a criminal.
Right, in criminal court.
Now, the pilots union was arguing that, look, we did the worst thing that we could ever do, or the harshest punishment, and that's we took away his pilot's license. The courts decided that apparently there was criminal negligence. He did get 2 years. The maximum penalty was 7, and they're upset that they didn't get the entire 7. The prosecutors were considering asking for life in prison on the grounds that the crash was deliberate. But of course, there was no evidence for that, so they had to bring it back. Their request was 4 years for criminal negligence. Of course, he did get 2. This is kind of blurring the lines a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So again, thanks to Steve from Australia for sending us those stories. We did get a question about the first 6 episodes that are still not able to be downloaded. They are correct. Those 6 were hosted on a different service that has since gone out of business. So I need to get those moved somewhere else, which takes quite a bit of time. And it is lower on my priority list now. But rest assured, I'll do it eventually. We do appreciate all listener feedback. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that by sending it to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Don't forget, we also have the voicemail. You can give us a call. That number is 812-757-4252. It'll ring straight to voicemail. Leave your message. We'll get you on the podcast. You can also record yourself. Email us the MP3, and we'll get you in the podcast. If there's a bit that you'd like to do, I know we've had some interest in that, let us know. We can't devote too much time to it because we don't want to go much over an hour, but let us know, and we'll try to get it in. We're looking, what was it, Max, about 5 to 10 minutes?
Yeah, 5 minutes sounds great.
We are definitely open to hearing from more of the aviation community that way. So we do appreciate all your feedback, as well as any support you can give us. The best way, of course, is by telling your friends, which we always appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And don't forget, leave us a review on iTunes. Max, we have quite a few reviews on iTunes, I noticed, which is great. Because
please do that. You know, good, bad, indifferent. Leave us a review.
Certainly. Of course, there's always Twitter. You can follow us. Our Twitter name is Airplane Geeks. You can also follow us individually. Mine is Miller22, and Max
is Max Flight.
And I try to post as much breaking news that hasn't already been posted, or interesting tidbits about aviation. But more importantly, we post when the episodes are published, which tends to vary based on my schedule and how I can edit the podcast. Don't forget to check us out on the website, on the web, airplanegeeks.com. On the right, we have our newsletter. Send that out weekly-ish. And I have more time to do that. So that newsletter will contain show notes as well as some of the other news stories that have taken place either during the week or between the time we recorded the podcast and the newsletter went out that we did not get into the podcast. So it should keep you up to date with the goings on in the aviation industry. Go to airplanegeeks.com and enter your email address in the right for the newsletter. We promise we won't give your email address to anybody else. Don't even really know how. So we promise we won't. Max, anything else? This is our chance to make sure you support Flightline Internet Radio, A Pilot Story, the documentary. Anybody that you hear on Airplane Geeks, we would definitely appreciate it. If you kind of strengthen the aviation community and the aviation new media community by supporting them as well. Cranky Flyer, Dan Webb, Richard Abulafia's blog. We definitely appreciate that, since we are all a community and we're all relying on one another. So we appreciate that very greatly.
Yeah, and there is a page off of our blog website, airplanegeeks.com, that lists all of the past guests. And it has links to their pages and some information about them. So if you want to kind of get caught up that way, or you remember somebody you'd like to get to know a little bit better online, you can look in there and find out where they are.
Certainly. Big thanks again to Richard Abulafia for joining us this evening. Don't forget to send us email to geeks@airplanegeeks.com. Max, I think I'm out of things to say.
I think that's about it. Hope everybody will join us next week.
We'll see you all next week on episode 44 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.